right, we begin Exodus tonight. We're going to be looking at chapters 1 and 2, but we're going to give some introductory information. This begins the new trimester, for Wednesday night at least. And we began Mark on Sunday, and we begin Exodus tonight. J.H. Hertz said, correctly so, that nearly all of the foundations of the Jewish life, of which the Jewish life is built, the Ten Commandments, the historical feasts, the leading principles of civil law, are contained in the book of Exodus. And the significance of that quote is that nearly everything we're going to see for the rest of the Old Testament concerning some of the laws, a reference to the tabernacle, to the Holy of Holies, etc., the priest's service, those kinds of things are going to begin in this book. This is a significant book. Baxter said, Is there in all of history a more amazing spectacle than the Exodus? Or more august and solemn revelation of God than at Sinai? Or a more significant piece of architecture than the Israelite tabernacle? Or more human figure than the man Moses? Or more influential national epoch than the founding of the Israel theocracy? All of these are found in the second book of Scripture. An amazing book indeed. Let's give some introductory information, as always is important. The name of the book, we open our English Bibles and we see the word Exodus for obvious reasons. But the Hebrew Bible called it the Shemoth. And you think, well, that's a different book. That was taken, it means names, and that's taken from the first line. Now, these are the names of the children of Israel. And that's where the Hebrew Bible had its name for the title for the book. The term Exodus is taken from the Septuagint translation. That is signified by that Roman numeral 70, standing for the 72 scholars that put that Hebrew to Greek translation together in 285 BC. It was the translation our Lord and the apostles used. In Exodus 19:1, if you want to turn over there, I'm not going to read that, but you'll see when they were departing, when they went out, depending on your translation, from Egypt, that departure or going out comes from the word exodos. And from that, the name was given and attached to the book, the Exodus. It just simply means the way out or the departure or the outgoing. So obviously, anyone who's already read the book of Exodus knows that this is where they go out from Egypt. It is the Exodus, and that's why we call it that name. The author is Moses. That I want to drop down to the very bottom of the bullet points. There's really no reason to question Moses as the author. That's generally the idea among students of the text that it is written by Moses, but here's some evidence thereof. The first five books are called the Law of Moses. The Jews, when they would talk about the law and the prophets, the law had reference to the Pentateuch, that is the first five books of the Bible. And sometimes in other books, they would be just simply referred to as Moses, not the law of Moses, but Moses. Not the man, but the books, Moses. In Moses it's written, etc. God told Moses to write. We see that in Exodus 17, Exodus 24, and Exodus 34. You can trace those references. But Joshua 8, 31 and 32 quotes from, or at least refers to Exodus 20 as coming from Moses. That tells me Moses must have wrote Exodus 20, or recorded it at least. Jesus in Mark 7 said, Moses said, and he quotes from Exodus 20, the giving of the Ten Commandments. Could be quoting from the rehearsal of that in Deuteronomy, but more likely quoting from Exodus 20. Mark 12, Jesus refers to Exodus 3 as from Moses. And so Exodus 3, Exodus 20 were written by Moses according to the Lord and according to Joshua. So there's really no reason to question that. Moses we take to be the author of the book. No big deal there. What's the message of the book? Well, you study several different works on that, and they're all going to be saying the same thing, though they may come at it from different angles. Some may talk about the book is about redemption, deliverance, about the going out, the Exodus, and all of those are saying the same thing with establishing a nation. Two major thoughts seem to be in the book. It covers deliverance from Egypt and the establishing of a nation. Now, God built a nation in the book of Genesis. He preserved that nation by carrying them into Egypt. Now, God's going to establish the nation. It's going to get bigger. It's going to grow. And by the time they come out of Egypt, there's going to be a large number. We're going to see here in just a little bit. Exodus chapter 6, Exodus 15 talks about God redeeming them. And you look at the context, read those verses, and it's talking about bringing them out of Egypt. So that's called a redemption, a deliverance. So what's the book about? It's about the deliverance from Egypt. But that's not all that's in the book. There's more. There's the establishing of a nation. Let's go to chapter 19 and in verse 6. I wanted to make sure I had the right reference there. I put the wrong verse up earlier today. But Exodus chapter 19 and in verse 6, God said, "You shall be a kingdom of priests, a holy nation." In other words, you're going to be a great nation. By the time they came out of Egypt, they already are a large nation. They're going to be even larger and great and established in their land. Make sense? And so what we're going to see is them coming out and going into their, headed toward their land. So God, the establishing of a nation. But the book tells us about more. It tells us the story of Moses. It covers 1/7 of the entire Bible. The story of Moses covers 1/7 of the entire Bible. That's 2/3 as much as the entire New Testament. So a great deal of information is given to us about Moses. This must be an important story. Does that make sense? If God revealed it, he must have wanted us to talk about it. We see the giving of the law. We're going to see the tabernacle that's mentioned time and again. Now, the dating of the book is important. It's not critical in the sense of like some books. Yeah, if you give an early date, it changes your view of the book than if you give a later date. For example, like the book of Revelation. Is it an early date or is it a late date? But that's not true here. The dates vary a little bit of the ideas. There's two different dates we want to talk about. One is the writing of the book. We don't know. But it would appear to be possibly toward the later part of Moses' life. As he's writing all of these books and recording all the books of Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, consisting then of the five and the Pentateuch. But of the Exodus itself, we're more interested in that, and how do we arrive at that? I'm going to go with the 1440 BC, though some will say 1290 BC, and Klassen will say 1462, and I follow Frank Klassen pretty closely. But I'm going to stick with 1440 here, and that may vary a little bit from some of the other dates we've given in Genesis. And so how do we come up with this date? Am I glued to that date that I wouldn't listen to anything else? No. But look at 1 Kings chapter 6 and in verse 1. In 1 Kings 6 and in verse 1, we learn that the temple was built 480 years after the Exodus. Now Solomon built the temple. It's generally thought and more agreed upon that the date for Solomon was around 960. Now, that's not 960 versus 958 or 959 or 961, 962. That's a general date, so don't hold me to an exact year. But around 960 for Solomon. Then we take those two numbers and we come up with 1440 B.C., approximately. So you may look up and somebody says, no, I think it was more like 1441, 1442 or 1450. I could care less about how exact that is. We can't be, we're still trying to differentiate between 1290 and 1440. I'm not worried about 2 or 3 years. So make sense how we come up with 1440? And if you are glued to 1290, and that's because of the 430-year date, and if we go with that, we have to split those dates, the 430 years, into two divisions. Willis talks about that in his little work. I'll leave that for you to work through. Since they wandered in the wilderness for 40 years, according to Numbers, then the entering the Canaan, which would be 40 years after they came out, would be about 1400 B.C. Again, that's not an exact date, but an roundabout round number. Make sense? All right, now that's the date I'm going to go with, and I'm willing to take a look at some other dates for whatever evidence may be there. I won't read all of that. Willis talks about this 430 years of Genesis 15, 13 would make the time of Abraham approximately 1900. Now let's talk about the years that are covered. Now this gets quite interesting to me. You might make a marginal note. By the time we left Genesis last week, and we open up Exodus, we just jump. Now, if you feel tired, this is why. You just jump 300 years. That's a pretty big gap. So we skipped about 300 years. And you say, that's a big gap. We're going to jump 400 years by the time we close the Old Testament till we come to the New Testament. So there are some big gaps. So about 300 years. We'll come back to that a little bit later. So the years that are covered are about 360 years from the death of Joseph to the tabernacle. It's about 360 years. There's this gap of 300 years from the death of Joseph to the birth of Moses. So we're looking at about 300 years since Joseph has died and our story tonight. Make sense? We see Joseph dying, and we'll talk more about that in just a second. Now, from the time they depart, and that's about Exodus 12, from there to the end of the book covers about a year. So we're going to slow the pace down as far as our calendar is concerned. So we just got real fast. We went fast forward 300 years, and we're going to slow down, and it's going to take us a while to get through a year. Making sense? Approximately a year from chapter 12 to chapter 40. All right, I like Baxter, as you know. I'll quote from him. He's not a member of the church, but I like his outline, how he outlines. And I like this outline. He takes Exodus, divides it in three sections. The Exodus, the law, the tabernacle. Quite simple to remember. And then under the Exodus, it was projected through Moses. It was obstructed through by Pharaoh. It was affected by Jehovah. And I won't go through the other details of the law and the tabernacle. We'll get those as we go along. So we're going to look at the Exodus, then we'll come to the law. We're not interested in the law right now, we're interested in the Exodus. Make sense? All right, a little more simplistic outline. Now you're going to see that again, so don't worry if you're trying to copy that. If you are not on the list, send me an email and ask to be put on the list to get these slides if you are having trouble copying them. This is a little more simplistic outline that the book deals with history, 1 to 18, the law, 19 to 40. And that includes laws concerning the tabernacle. But I like Baxter's outline better. All right, questions or comments on where we're going and what the book is all about? They are in Egypt. As we open the book, this is where we left them. Remember, this is the land of Canaan. They have made their way over to Egypt. And Ramses is where they are in that general region in the land of Goshen, which is about where my little arrow is right here, somewhere right in the land of Goshen. It's more of a elongated section. And what we're going to see in the book, to kind of get an overview of the book, we're going to see them come out of Egypt, make their way through into the down to Sinai, and there's going to be the giving of the tabernacle, and that's about where we're going to leave them by the time we leave the book of Exodus. Make sense? We're not going to journey a long ways in the book. That's more in the book of Numbers. Making sense? Questions, comments? Let's go to question number one for tonight. What's chapter one about? All right, very good. Yeah, they are afflicted in Egypt. They're suffering in Egypt. And chapter 2, what's it about? Yeah, the birth of Moses and the early part of his life, the first 40 years of his life, and starting in the second 40 years. We'll divide those out into three periods in just a few moments. All right, let's go to question number five. How did the new king treat God's people? Made slaves of them. Not all slaves are treated bad. So let's go a step further. Very heavy burdens. Treated them with rigor. Harsh treatment. Say again. All right, yeah. Wanted to kill their children. I take it from later in chapter 2, they were beating them, attacking them physically, not just slave drivers in the sense they're making them work hard. More about that as we go along. Question number seven. Moses came from which tribe? Levi. And why did he flee to Midian? Question number eight. All right. Killed an Egyptian and he was found out. All right, let's see. What question was it? Let's get to this one right here. Number four, how many people of Jacob's family went into Egypt? 70 to 75. We go with number 70. We went through those discrepancies of numbers earlier, a week or two ago, so I won't go through that again. But let's go with 70 that went in. How many came out according to Exodus 12? Yeah, 2 to 3 million perhaps. Because the number that's given is how many? 600,000 men, fighting men of age 20 and above. So that didn't include women, that didn't include children, that didn't include other men. Make sense? These are fighting men. So the estimates are somewhere between, some say as low as 1.5, some say 2, some say 3. We're looking at, let's just say 2 million people at least. We don't know the number, we just know the number of fighting men. All right, here's Exodus 1 now. Let's talk about Exodus chapter 1. Now, you might make a marginal note that we have jumped 300 years, as we've already mentioned, from the death of Joseph, the end of Genesis, to the birth of Moses. So we're going to see something about his death here in verses 1 to 7. So number of the children of Israel are growing in Egypt. That's the verses 1 to 7. These are the names of those that went into Egypt. And so we have the names mentioned. The number 70 is given at verse 5. Joseph was already there. And then Joseph died, but the children were fruitful and they increased abundantly and they grew exceedingly and mightily. Joseph, you remember, was 110 when he died. We saw that in our study last time. That would be 70 years after his, approximately, that's a round number, after the family came into Egypt. We didn't talk much about that. That would have been 70 years. And you say, how'd you get to 70? He was 17 in Genesis 37. Remember that? And he was 22 years by the time his brothers came. So at least 22. And you add those numbers together is 39. And you take the 110 and subtract the 139 gives you 71. So approximately 70 years. That's where we're getting that number. So it's been 70 years after the family came into Egypt is when he died. And then we're jumping 300 years to the time of Moses. Now a new king has arisen. Which king was this? We don't know. You read one commentary and he is assured it's Ramses II. And the next one is assured it could not be. It would not fit in the timetable. I'm not sure which king it was. He's not identified. We'll leave it at that. Willis suggests in his little work, and he's a pretty good student of history, that it was probably, he puts it that way, Ramses II. And so what difference is it going to make? I haven't figured out any difference it's going to make, whether you convince me it was or wasn't. But anyway, what was different about this king? He didn't understand. He didn't know Joseph, didn't know the Israelites, didn't understand the relationship they had had. And consequently, beginning now at verse 8 through verse 14, he makes slaves out of them. So what do we see in 8 through 14? Or let's start with this question. Why was he concerned about them? Absolutely, yes. He's concerned that they're growing. Look at verse 9, mightier. They're more than mightier than us, and we need to deal wisely. That's an interesting phrase. We need to deal wisely with them. Wisely includes killing their sons. Wisely includes throwing their sons into the river. Wisely includes making them slaves, treating them with rigor. So when somebody comes along and says that they have wisdom, be careful because their wisdom may not be all that that great. All right, verse 11. They built for Pharaoh supply cities in two cities, Pithom and Ramses. And here are the two cities. Now, this shaded area is generally a little bit larger than that area we have seen on the map is the land of Goshen. And so he had them to be slaves and to build these cities of Pithom and Ramses. And they're working vigorously in that. Now I'm interested in, if I can get my pages apart, chapter 1 and in verse verse 13 and 14, that the Egyptians made the children serve with rigor and made their lives bitter, and the brick and mortar, etc., and the services and all their service which they did made them serve with rigor. Let's go back to chapter 46 and in verse 3, I think is the verse I'm looking for. Actually, what I was wanting to tie this with is not verse 13, 14, it's verse 12. That's the verse I missed. I kept looking for my phrase. And they were the dread of the children of Israel. They were in dread of the children of Israel. That's the phrase I'm looking for. The Egyptians became dreadful and fearful of the children of Israel. That's the point I'm driving at. Couldn't find it. All right, go to chapter 46, verse 3. God had told Jacob, I will make a great nation of you. You see the connection? They were in dread of them, not because they were such strong people. They were in dread of them because they're growing and multiplying and getting bigger, becoming a great nation. And so what God's doing, and we've been flagging in Genesis providence passages, watch for providence here, at least in the first part of this book. God's hand is involved in them multiplying and being delivered. Obviously, God, it's by his power, but God's going to put some things in play. And that's part of the providence. All right, any questions down through verse 14? All right, let's start at verse 15 now. And I'm in the wrong chapter now. At verse 15 through 22, the king commands that the baby sons be killed. Now, we're going to look for a couple of things here with reference to providence. At verse 15, the king spoke to the Hebrew midwives. The name of one was Shiphrah, and the name of the second one was Puah. Now, what did they say to these two midwives? Yeah, as you're assisting them in the birth, as you're delivering the child, kill the male child and save the female child. You might underline it verse 17. But the midwives feared God. While you're underlining, jump down to verse 21. And so it was because the midwives feared God. Now, what does it mean to fear God? Stand in awe? Okay. They're fearful of displeasing God. They stand in awe of God. And in this context, there is more concern about God than there is about the king. The king could kill them, couldn't he? He could take their head off. If you're going to kill babies, he could kill the midwives. If the babies' lives are worthless, the midwives' lives are worthless. And yet they had more concern about God than they did about the king. Powerful lesson to learn from that. And I'm seeing God using two women here that feared God. Why did they happen to be the midwives? You see, providence may be coming to play. Providence is always a perhaps. Perhaps that was providence that these two women, instead of two other women, happened to be the ones in the role of being midwives. Now, I want to go just a little further before we leave that section. Look at verse 17. When the king of Egypt found out about that, says, why have you done this thing and saved the male children alive? And what did they say? Yeah, they're quite capable of birthing their children before we get there, and they are lively and they give birth before the midwives even come. So we weren't there. Is that the case? I don't know. Were they so lively? If so, again, there may be the hand of providence that these women were giving birth before the midwives showed up. That may be the case. Or were they saying that for their protection? I'm not sure of that. Any observation on that? I'm not sure of anybody that knows for sure of that. If we take it on face value, which may be the best way to approach verse 19, then the fact that these women were strong enough and able enough without the aid of these midwives to give birth, at least at this point, or maybe they had been using these midwives before, that may be a touch of the hand of God or the providence of God. Does that make sense? I'm trying to flag some potential providence here that I think I see in the context. Therefore, let's jump down to verse 20 now. Here again. Therefore, God dealt with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew mightily. Remember Genesis 46, 3, I'm going to build a great nation out of you. God's building a great nation. One of the tools is God's providence here. He protected them earlier. Now, 300 years later, he seems to either have some midwives in place that are the right ones, or perhaps made some women stronger or able to deliver the children without the aid of the midwife. Making sense? God's working out his plan. God's working out his purpose. Now, verse 21, what does the fear suggest here? Because of this fear, what happens? Blessed who? These midwives. God took care of them because they had helped take care of his people. And so God blessed them. A great deal of information there on the fear of God, what fear means. We'll come back to some practical things a little later if we have time. So then, it's interesting to me, what you would expect on a cursory reading is that Pharaoh would execute these wives. But he didn't. And it may be that God had provided households for them, and well, God did protect them. But maybe the Hebrews took them in so that they were not easily found or detected. I'm not sure why that's the case. But anyway, verse 20, Pharaoh then has another plan. What's his second plan? Just throw them in the river. And every daughter you save alive. So let's take all the boys and let's destroy them and let's throw them in the river and let's drown them. No respect for human life at all. Questions or comments on chapter 1? Good point. All right, chapter 2. Any questions on chapter 1? Comments? So what we accomplished in chapter 1 is the children of Israel are suffering in Egypt, and despite the suffering, they're growing because that's what God had promised. One of the things, I keep flagging this concept of providence, but do you see perhaps that God is going to use the cruelty of the Egyptians as a reason to get them out and deliver them? That there wouldn't be the demand for deliverance. There wouldn't be the great need on the part of the Hebrews to see the need for deliverance, were they treated just so kindly and just blended into society. God didn't want them to blend into the Egyptian society. That was part of the reason of bringing them out of Canaan. Remember that? God brings them out of Canaan because they were assimilating into the society, and he sends them out down into Egypt, and they don't assimilate that well into the society. So God's going to use, it didn't cause, but God's using the cruelty of the Egyptians to accomplish his purpose. He wants to get them back to the land of Canaan, and he's going to do that. So if nothing else, I'm learning from this. Sometimes God uses something that may be even wrong within itself. God can take that and use it for his advantage. And it may be just try to deter someone else from doing wrong, but God can take that evil and that wrong and use it for his advantage. Let's go to chapter 2 now. Chapter 2, we have Moses' birth in his early life. He was hidden by his mother, verses 1 to 4. We don't know anything about Moses till we read here. Again, assuming this is our first cursory reading of that. This birth would be, if my calculation be right, I think we're looking at about 1520 B.C., about 80 years before the Exodus. When this is taking place, the birth is taking place. But let's talk about him being hidden by his mother. that there was a man of the house of Levi who took a daughter of Levi. So let's talk about the family of Moses. Now the print's a little small, but we have here Levi, and what I want you to see is Kohath was the son of Levi. Amram was the father of Moses, so that makes Moses the great-grandson of Levi. Making sense? Trying to get just kind of a bearing of where we are, how far we are away from the children of Israel, that is the descendants of Jacob is who I'm talking about. And Levi was one of the sons of Jacob. And so here is Moses. He has a brother Aaron. His wife Zipporah, that we're going to talk about in a moment, had a sister, which is mentioned in this text. She's not named here, but Miriam, we see her later. Zipporah has a father named Jethro that we're going to see in our context. We're going to see one of the sons mentioned today, Gershom. So that's a little of the family tree right there for what it may be worth to you. We'll see that again. This is not the last time you'll see that. But we're looking at the great-grandson of Levi. So there was a man of Levi, which is right here, Amram, and he marries a woman of Levi, and she conceives and she has a child. Making sense? All right. So let's continue through verse 4. She found that the child was beautiful, but because of the decree of the previous chapter, she could no longer hide him, and she made her an ark of bulrushes and dabbed it with asphalt and pitch and put the child in it and put it by the reeds by the riverbank. The reeds by the riverbank were common throughout Egypt, I understand. Your translation may say, the English Standard says it was, she covered it and daubed it with not asphalt, but bitumen. The American Standard will say slime. The New American Standard 95 will say that it was tar. What was that? Well, the word gives the idea, inherent in the word, I understand, the Hebrew word gives the idea of a reddish substance. And that there was a reddish substance that often would come up from the bottom of the water or come up from below the ground, much like tar, and that it would be in a liquid form and that it could easily be spread like you would think of tar, but set it out in the sun and it dries hard. So whatever the substance was, probably tar or bitumen, if you know what that is, or some kind of slime that hardens, you can think of something that as we would think of paint, you spread it on and it hardens as it dries. And so she covers this made of bulrushes and makes it basically waterproof so she can float him in the waters. Make sense? All right. And the sister stood afar off. That's Miriam. She's not named here. We see her later named in the book, but not here. She stands afar off watching. Now, I see again the hand of providence here. That God's working out his purpose. He's going to need a leader. And here's a man named Moses, that are going to be named Moses, that it just so happened that the very river where babies are being thrown to be destroyed, there's a baby going to be saved from that same river. That's interesting to me. But look at verse 5. What happens beginning at verse 5? This also seems to be just a coincidence. Or providence, maybe. Pharaoh's daughter, the daughter of the very man who wants the destruction of all the babies, she comes with her maidens with her, and they see the baby and go and rescue the baby. And then what happens? Yeah. Do you need one of the Hebrew women to take care of it? I'll go get you a nurse to take care of it. And she says yes. And when she comes, what does Pharaoh's daughter offer? I'll pay you. She didn't realize, I'm offering to pay you to take care of your own baby and save your own baby. Take care of your baby for me and I'll pay you the wages. And do what? She may have. I don't know. We're not told. And so she goes and finds the mother, and she takes care of the child. Now notice at verse 10, the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. so that she, and called his name Moses because it drew him out of the water. Now, I'm interested at verse 10 about him going to the house of hold of Pharaoh and being raised in the house of Pharaoh. And stayed there for a good while. That is, he was raised to maturity and adulthood at the house of Pharaoh. Hebrews 11 gives us some insight that there came a time when he no longer wanted to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. But as you study and harmonize Acts 7 and Hebrews 11 and all these texts with reference to Moses, that many think that he could have been an heir to the throne. That she formally, apparently, adopted him, made him her child, whatever that process may have involved, so that he could have been an heir to the throne had he wanted to be. But he didn't want to be. God didn't want him to be either. But we'll make a point from verse 10 in just a moment. Now let's go on to verse 11. What happens in 11, starting at verse 11? All right. Now let's stop and talk about, you might want to make a marginal note, Moses is 40 years old at this point. You say, how do you know? Because Acts 7 tells me that. Acts 7 in verse 23. So you might want to put some marginal notes right here, or you might make a note to see Acts 7. But the life of Moses is divided by three periods of 40 years each, and here they are. He was in Egypt for 40 years. And then he went to Midian at age 40. And he was there for 40 years, according to Acts 7 and in verse 30. And then when he came out of the land of Egypt, came back to Egypt, he came when he was came out with the children of Israel, he wandered in the wilderness for how long? 40 years, verse 36. So verse 23, 30, and 36. Make sense? All right, so there's 40 years each. His life is divided by three periods of 40 years. So at this juncture, at this point, here we are at verse 11, he is 40 years old. All right? Now, he's going to flee to the land of Midian. The land of Midian is over here. Some, we'll get to this a little bit later, think Sinai should be over here on this side. There's a discrepancy among some students where Sinai. We'll get to that later. We're going to go with the traditional route and the traditional place at the moment, that this is Sinai. Some think the land of Midian encompassed part of what we call the Sinai Peninsula here. Maybe so. So was he over here in the land of Midian, or was he still over here on this side? I don't know. He got out of Egypt and fled to the land that was the land of Midian, is where he fled to. Now, here's the interesting thing. Acts 7:25. Take a look at that. What was Moses thinking? Now, before you answer that, let's set the pace here. That Moses comes to the Hebrews, and he sees an Egyptian beating one of his brethren, and he looks around and he kills him. And there's a reason he did that. He thought what? Acts 7:25. Yeah. He thought they would understand that God was using him to deliver him. God's going to. There is no evidence that God had told him to do that. So here's a practical thing I'm learning from that. Here's a man who is seeking to be a deliverer, but he's kind of like Abraham. I'm going to have a child, and so I'm going to have to figure out how God's going to do this instead of letting God do that. And so Abraham or Moses is, I'm going to be the deliverer of these people, and he's going to do it in this manner, in this way, and that wasn't God's way. Here's another practical lesson, and I'll incorporate with something else here in just a moment, but that there was failure on his part, and there was a lesson to learn. You're going to do it God's way or it doesn't work. So he had to go off to Midian for 40 years and wait this out. And so if you're going to do something, do it God's way. When you do it your way, you're going to have serious consequences. Moses did. And we'll come back to that if time permits. All right. Now then, the next day, what happens? He hadn't gone to Midian yet. He thinks he's got away with this. Yeah. And he tries to stop the fight, and they ask him, are you going to kill us like you did that Egyptian? And he realized this thing is surely known. And so he took off and fled to Midian. Now he gets off in the land of Midian. What happens over in Midian? He sits by to rest on a well, Yeah, there are seven daughters that come from that are daughters of Zipporah, and they come to water their animals, and they're doing that, and then what happens to them? Shepherds come and run them off, and so he defends her and are the women, and when they get back, the dad asks, well, how'd you get back so quick? Notice at verse 21, that they go have the man come home, bring bread, and then the text jumps forward for a little time space, and he gave Zipporah, his daughter, to Moses. And then the first son to be born is Gershom at verse 22, if you care to underline and mark those. Now then, verse 23 and 24 and 25 shifts gears. While this is going on, while Moses is over here, it's like if this were a camera scene. We see Moses over here, and he's getting married and having children. He's got some maturing to do. The camera goes back over to Egypt. What's going on in Egypt? Yeah, the king of Egypt died, and the children groaned. God's going to hear their groaning. In fact, you might make a marginal note to see chapter 6 and in verse 5. God said, I've heard also the groaning of the children of Israel. So make a marginal note. I've heard the groaning of the children of Israel. And God said, I remember the promise made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so God looked upon the children and acknowledged them. So God's going to make a call in the next chapter for the calling of Moses. Now, I want to go back just for a moment if I might borrow an outline from Warren Wiersbe. God is preparing Moses for his task. Wiersbe gives 4 points. He prepared him with a godly home, chapter 2, verses 1 to 10. That makes sense, doesn't it? You prepare him with a godly home. If it had ungodly parents, they may have just thrown their baby in the river to start with. But they're trying to preserve this baby because they're godly parents. God prepared him for his task by special education, raising him as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Perhaps that helps him in dealing with the Egyptians. God prepared him with great failure. God didn't cause this failure in verses 11 to 15, but I want to tell you, Moses learned a lesson there. Sometimes when we make an effort and we fail, we learn a powerful lesson from that that'll help us not to do that again. And God prepared him for his task with the long delay. That is, he has to go off and wait 40 years before God's going to use him. He thought he was ready to be the deliverer, but it's going to be 40 years before he is. Isn't that interesting? God's saying, you're not ready, and I'm not ready for you to be the deliverer. It's going to be 40 years. Now, God didn't tell him it's going to be 40 years, but he sends him off to Midian. He's going to stay there 40 years before he can come back. God got him ready for his task. God may be getting you ready for a task, and you're wondering, what's the delay? And he may be working something out. Make sense? Our time is gone. Chapters 3 to 5, next time.